Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Season 2, Episode 3 of Tech Plus Plus. I'm your host, Ali. Joining me is Aaron.
Hey, what's up, everybody? I'm glad to be here.
And also joining us today, we have a good friend of the show, Kevin. Would you like to introduce yourself, Kevin?
How's it going? Kevin, I'm a coworker of Aaron's, and I'm super passionate about blockchain in the industry. Been involved for a while, and excited to talk about it.
Thank you, Kevin. As you could have guessed, today we will be discussing blockchain and the nature of cryptocurrencies. But before we jump into it, please ensure to follow us on our social media, Tech Plus Plus Podcast on Instagram. That's Tech PLUS PLUS Podcast on Instagram. And Tech Plus Plus _ on Twitter. That's Tech PLUS PLUS _ on Twitter to stay up to date with our latest news and stay in touch with us. So shall we jump into it? Kevin, take it away with a bit of history.
Sure. Yeah. So I'm just going to start off for the uninitiated and just kind of the short history. So 2009, after the housing market collapse, when the huge bailout happened, some people on the internet forums were upset about this and did not think that it was right that a third party, in this case, the Federal Reserve, the central banking system, had access to devalue their currency by printing more and raising inflation. So this was like the original use case. And then Satoshi Nakamoto, the pseudonym that nobody knows, supposedly created this protocol, the Bitcoin protocol, as a way of having individuals around the world come to consensus on data, which is that data would be monetary data.
The data would be public.
The data would be public, correct, and secure. So everybody can agree on it, everybody can see it, and nobody can mess with it. Those are the key foundations of what makes the blockchain effective. The other goal was not just to have this new monetary system, but have this monetary system exist on a network, on the internet, right? It's not just that we have the ability to do this, but that we can do this on a worldwide scale. So that was the initial plan, right? That's what set this whole thing off. And then it kind of trickled around and it's effective, right? You know, the whole Silk Road thing that was built upon it, right? You have this whole black market industry that, whether, you know, it was bad, but it, the foundational network functioned. So it was kind of a proof of concept thing.
That was kind of a crazy thing. It's like, there's some bad people in there, but it did prove that this marketplace of public transparent transactions
can occur, correct?
Yeah.
And then, you know, the government would caught Ross Ulbricht, who was the creator of the Silk Road, and they're like, they jailed him and they took his Bitcoin because they were able to catch him with his laptop open at the time. But there's no way that they were able to take down the network, because you can take down, you know, one server here or one server there, but there's still the back end. The back end still exists. And so because of the distributed nature, it's not taken down anymore. Right? So these things start to add, and it proves out this network. And then in like 2015, this character, Vitalik Buterin, he's an interesting, young, quirky person. I don't know if either of you have ever seen him. He decided, you know, that this concept's incredible, but we can add more to this. So the way you interact with the Bitcoin protocol to, you know, most users is going to be with a wallet or through an exchange, right? Sure. And these wallets and exchanges basically just package up what we know as like API calls to this backend and provide a user interface, right? Mm-hmm. So the Bitcoin network will allow certain types of transactions, right? You can send, you can, you know, query a balance, and there's a few other operations you can do, right? Like a send transaction might involve three operations: check the balance, you know, do this, send the money. And so that'll be packaged up into a wallet where you push like send and it's one button, but there'll be multiple calls. Okay. Mm-hmm. And Vitalik was like, this is cool. You know, we have this function where we can send, we have secure data. This is all great, but I want to have more, and I want to have more control over what API calls I can have. And this is where, like, this is where the whole space gets really fun and interesting, because now we don't just have a ledger of account values. Now we have a ledger of smart contracts, which are, it's a way of essentially having your own protocol on this network. So one of the simplest explanations is going to be like a decentralized exchange, right? So
before we get into that sort of stuff, we've talked about decentralization, and I just want to have you maybe explain that for the listeners, because that's such a key concept in everything that's going on and what we're talking
about. Sure. So the decentralization comes from the fact that anywhere in the world, there's miners, is what they're called, right? And Bitcoin they're miners. Processing, right? And they're processing these transactions that everybody submits. All these calls, you know, send money here, blah, blah, blah. They're processing all of this. And unlike a traditional service, whether it's banking or any other service, the backend is typically centralized in like an AWS web server or some other location where there's a single authority in charge of managing that. And because of that, things can get taken down. You know, not to get political at all, but Parler was a recent example of when this happened, right? Things can be shut down. And so this decentralizes, what it does is people, you know, you have a guy in China, you can have a guy in Canada, and they're all talking to each other, agreeing on what values to store on this database, essentially. And it's a very powerful thing.
And so with all that, like all the data, right? All the data is stored across all devices. So when one device goes down, it doesn't, like when a single server is compromised, it doesn't mean the entire thing is compromised, because the data is everywhere and nobody has like all the same data. The entire data within like blockchain itself is distributed among however many devices.
Totally. And with the distributed nature, it's hard to mislead people, right? Like if you want to say, you know, this data is false, you know, you're just one actor among a sea of actors. So they're not, you don't have sway, you know. And that's when you can start talking about the 51% attack on the Bitcoin network, which is a legitimate threat vector, right? If you can have most of the nodes, you can affect malicious behavior.
Oh wow. Didn't even think about that.
Yes. So to make a blockchain effective in the eyes of its true creators, it is supposed to be as decentralized as possible. Now, the truth is that's not actually where the network is now, right? Like China has a large portion of the mining power because they have, you know, the ability to make these ASIC chips that gives them the advantage and cheap power. And it's a whole sea of things. But so it's, you know, and you can't, because of the scale of, you know, the money at this point, you know, you're not mining on a laptop anymore. You need serious equipment.
You brought up, sorry about that, quick question. You brought up mining. A lot of people are still a bit confused, because I personally get a lot of that question of like, what exactly is mining?
Okay, this is a great question. And there's two parts to mining. With Bitcoin specifically, there's phase A and there's phase B, essentially. Now, phase A, we are in phase A at the moment.
Okay.
Bitcoin has a set number of Bitcoins that can be in existence. It's roughly 21 million. We don't have all of those minted yet. They're not all existing. So when the creators were like, how are we going to get this network to spread and have people do this, right? How do we incentivize people to do this? So miners in the beginning, which is where we are now, still phase A, they get, when they mine and process transactions and find the next block in the blockchain, they're rewarded with new Bitcoins and a small transaction fee that we pay. Like if I send Aaron Bitcoin, I'm going to pay a fee called in Ethereum, it's called a gas fee. And, you know, that goes to the miners that solve the puzzle. Okay. And now once we get to phase B, once all the Bitcoins are out, right, now the network has reached scale. It's distributed across the world, is the hope, right? And now the miners, what's going to keep them mining is just our transaction fees. So mining is very rewarded early. And every certain amount of time cycles, there's something called a halving, which means, so let's say, you know, you discover a block, you get 10 Bitcoins. Next time cycle, the halving occurs. Now the prize is down to 5 Bitcoins. Mm-hmm. And this keeps happening. And now you can see how the number of new Bitcoins minted tails off to 21 million.
That sounds similar to decay when you're talking about nuclear, like, power.
Exactly. Like exactly. Okay. Decay. Exactly. Okay. The same concept.
So the more,
which is brilliant.
So the more and more coins that are found, and I assume we're pretty close to that number now. Not that close, but we're getting close to that number. Because I understand that right now, that every time you mine, you get like very, very small fraction of one Bitcoin.
Yes, I don't remember the current block reward off the top of my head. But yes. And just to be clear, it's not like you're finding these Bitcoins. You're guessing and checking a one-way hash function until you get it right.
Interesting. I do see that how it's going to get harder and harder and harder, and it takes a lot more, like, especially GPU power at this point,
right,
to get there. Interesting.
So Bitcoin is a proof of concept, and it's interesting, but like, we're already starting to get into some of these flaws, right? Like, the hashing power is immense, right? Like, it requires huge amounts of technology, infrastructure, electricity, and then,
not to go too ahead. Far off on a tangent, but like, would like a supercomputer, a quantum computer, like affect that at all?
Yes. Okay. That's a very interesting. This is a bit of a tangent.
I don't want to go on the tangent fully, but
essentially, to summarize, an effective quantum computer that has, you know, enough qubits, I don't know the number off the top of my head, is able to solve hash functions, which the SHA-256 algorithm would be, yes, it'd be threatened, to put it simply. But again, who has that power? It almost turns into nuclear warfare.
Yeah,
right?
I was gonna like, say that. Can, like,
if I'm you can break into anything, and anybody can break into anything, do we really want to destroy everybody's financial systems at the same time? No.
That's actually pretty interesting, because I'm pretty close to I don't know if you're aware of Lawrence Livermore.
No, who's that?
It's like one of the bigger national laboratories that's close to us.
Their research laboratory, yeah.
And they are very close to having like a quantum computer. I can only imagine that they're like, hey, fuck it, I'm just gonna take all the Bitcoin now.
That's crazy. So it is very crazy. It's very crazy. But again, I don't want to go down that whole tangent. It's interesting.
Yeah.
There's other algorithms and other stuff that people do that are quantum resistant blockchains, right? So there's all these, you know, Bitcoin is not a perfect protocol, right? There's weaknesses, transaction rate, right? It doesn't come close to Visa's transactions per second. You know, when huge volumes of transactions are coming through, like if you talk Visa level, then the price of transaction gas fees skyrockets, and it becomes almost not entirely usable, right? You can't buy a cup of coffee for $1 if the transaction fee is 70.
Yeah.
So,
wow.
Yeah, there's issues, but again, the way that most institutional investors are looking at Bitcoin in today's world is not as like the new digital currency that's going to take over every transaction. They're looking at it as a hedge against traditional monetary system, and more to park large amounts of money, not to really use it, right? Think like bonds and gold.
It seems as if Bitcoin has found their niche or whatever.
Yeah, they're basically trading it now, right? Like, especially like, I think it got a lot more fame when Robinhood brought it into their system to be traded. It's more or less being seen more as like a stock than as a money, you know?
Yeah, and the Robinhood thing, is they don't let you withdraw, which is a whole other issue. But again, if you let me talk, we can go down a million tangents here that will just never end. I want to try and target back more towards the decentralized applications and the next step, right? Okay. So Bitcoin has these issues that we've discussed, and this guy Vitalik is like, okay, well, I think it should be more decentralized. So he's trying to make the computation mining built around, you know, consumer power, which is just one of his goals. I don't know if that's exactly played out, but that was the initial. And then the smart contracts. So a smart contract is a way that you can put your own protocol onto this blockchain, right? So Ethereum allows you to like create your own protocols. So instead of just having send, request balance, etc., you now have this ability to write what's called Solidity, is the programming language that you write these smart contracts. And you can write them and put them on the blockchain. By the nature of the blockchain, they're write only, right? You can't edit old data. So you want to make sure you write it correctly. Kind of a pretty important thing. You get one deployment.
And that's a fundamental piece to all of this too, right? Is you're not going back to editing previous data.
Yeah, there's only, it's write only.
Okay.
You know, forward. You can't go back and edit stuff. Mm-hmm. And so to kind of help wrap your mind around a dApp, the easiest way to explain it is with peer-to-peer exchanges, because it's something that everybody can simply wrap their mind around. So I have Ethereum, okay? And I want to trade with Aaron. He's somewhere else in the world. He could be anywhere. Mm-hmm. How do I do this, right? We don't trust each other. How are we going to make this handoff, right? And so the way we do this is we create a protocol here. We can either go through an exchange where we have a third party like Coinbase.
Handle it. Okay.
Handle it. Or we can use cryptography and the ability to, you know, make a handshake and go through this protocol. So this smart contract will physically hold money. So it is a third party. It has a wallet. It has its own address. It will physically hold value and on the blockchain. So it is a third party. You kind of have to think of it like that.
Or as another entity within the exchange between me and you.
Correct. But it's a contract. So it's not editable. And it's this piece of code that we're both going to enter into. And it's going to process things for us.
Okay.
Now, this is not free. This is not free. Backend costs money.
Yes.
Why Amazon's so rich. And so you have to pay mining. You have to pay the miners to do this. And this is the gas fees. Now, if you have a contract that has lots of, let's call them API calls, you're going to have an expensive contract to interact with. Mm-hmm. So people who write good contracts, write secure, they manage, you know, they look through every state the contract to be in, because if you mess up, money disappears. Mm-hmm. Right. So you have to have a good contract. It's going to be secure, audited, and simple. And so these are the ones that are working right now. So Uniswap is an example. There's SushiSwap is another example of this peer-to-peer style contract where I can exchange different Ethereum or Ethereum-based tokens on this contract. So what's an Ethereum token? An Ethereum token is another contract. It's they're called ERC-20 is the typical. Oh,
that's where ERC
standard is the typical standard that people use when they will deploy a new token. So Aaron can get the ERC-20 template and go, I'm gonna make Aaron coin, and we're gonna you know, sell this. Well, the SEC would be not okay with that at this time, but this is how the tech works. So you can do that, and you can have these tokens now, and you can say, here's this contract. This contract's going to, you know, keep track of all of this information, and you can send whatever. You can have different ways and rules of moving your tokens around. This is called tokenomics, if you've ever heard of the term. this is when like people have all different types of ideas, right? There's like, you know, we give some contracts, we'll give a token to every Ethereum address. So people, if you open it, you'll just have these tokens. Other ones will, offer different ways of distributing and incentivizing and trying to scale. We're trying to integrate with different projects.
For all these things, there's a singular source contract that explodes into the network of what is, like, for example, Bitcoin today.
So Bitcoin is its own protocol, separate thing. And then there's Ethereum, which has its blockchain that allows smart contracts. It's currently the only one that really allows smart contracts.
But if I wanted to create a smart contract for like Tech++ coin or like the Dogecoin or whatever, that starts with a singular source contract?
Correct.
So everything is tracked from that source point, basically.
Correct. And these source points have an address that like in a database on the blockchain. And the way you view these is through a block explorer. Okay. So a block explorer is your tool, your window, your GUI to get to the blockchain to see whatever you want to see. You can see really cool metrics. You can, hash rates, new volumes of wallets opening up. I mean, any type of data that you want to get from this, you can see. Nice. And so if somebody's considering investing in anything, you have technical knowledge, a good place to start is let's look at this contract. Let's see how many of these tokens exist, total supply. Mm-hmm. Let's see if one address has 99% of them and can just tank, control the market. There's lots of things that you can investigate and learn by looking at a smart contract.
For all those things, what's crazy is you have full transparency. If you wanted to look at a company in the same respect, you can't
never
get that full transparency.
Never, ever. Yeah, it's crazy. That's one of the things that frustrated me initially about Bitcoin, right? Because when the Silk Road was happening, they're like, this is people are, laundering money, and this private network is allowing people to, operate anonymously. Meanwhile, cash is very anonymous. There's no trace. You'll never see where a dollar moves. I'd say way more money is laundered in dollars. And you can see every transaction history on an account. So once you link an account, a Bitcoin address, public address to an individual, you can very quickly follow the money trail. And they've done it and jailed many people. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a misnomer that it's anonymous. Now, there are anonymous cryptos, like Monero is anonymous. And that gets into fungibility, which is like a whole nother thing. But we'll talk about that.
Well, I definitely wouldn't touch on that later. Yeah.
But see, it's so interesting. Like there's so much.
Kevin, since we're talking about like trading with Bitcoin, another widely popular question that I've heard of going around is who drives the price? Who says how much should Ethereum be? How much should Bitcoin be? How does that work?
So a lot of it is traditional market forces, right? Do you guys know what arbitrage is? Are you familiar?
No.
So arbitrage is, let's say there's an exchange A and exchange B. And exchange B, people are very exuberant about the price of something, Bitcoin, right. Ethereum, whatever. And they start buying. And this, let's say it's in Korea or somewhere. And there's this, huge marketing thing. And people are like, I got to get Bitcoin now. And they start buying. And the price goes up on that exchange. Now, exchange A in America isn't really moving, right? So there'll be a price discrepancy between these two exchanges. Mm-hmm. Price discrepancy means you can make money. So I will buy Bitcoin at exchange A, let's say, let's call the price $10,000, okay? Mm-hmm. And then I will withdraw that Bitcoin, send it over to the other exchange where the price might be $15,000, and I'll sell it. Mm-hmm. And then I'll take the money and I'll repeat that transaction as fast as I can until market forces start bringing those prices back together.
I see.
That sounds like almost like shorting.
It's not. You're just. This is how goods move, right? Like, if metal, steel in one country is short and they need a lot of it, you know, there's a shortage of supply, and it's less valuable here, they'll ship it over there. It's just kind of how it is. The other thing that moves the price is going to be people who have large amounts, right? If you have a huge amount, you sell, you will move the price down, and vice versa up. So they're called whales typically, and so they also have the ability to move price.
Let's see. So it's not like an actual like a group or anything controlling the price. It's more of like the law of just regular supply and demand.
Yes, there is a caveat. So there's this thing called Tether. I don't know if you've heard this. It's what's called a stable coin. So it's supposed to be pegged at an asset, at a value of an asset.
And interesting.
So it's a dollar. And so there's a group, like a third party physical company or entity, that will take in dollars and issue Tether. Now, there's multiple stable coins. There's Tether, there's DAI, there's USDC. They all serve the same function of pegging a cryptocurrency to the dollar. And there's tax reasons why you want to do this. You want to stay in crypto land. But there's a very high probability for foul play with Tether because they've never undergone an audit and they've issued lots of Tether. Like, I don't know the number off the top of my head, but billions and billions of dollars Tether. No. Do they actually have billions and billions of dollars in an account?
Oh man,
I don't know.
That's scary to think about.
That is a price force, right? This is new money. This is considered equivalent to dollars that have just appeared out of nowhere and are now buying Bitcoin, moving the price.
It's hard to think that all of those are hard, cold, cash-backed Tether.
It's hard to imagine. Now, if you look at USDC, you know, that's what, you know, Coinbase has undergone audits and stuff. You can trust that.
Yeah.
So everything needs its due diligence, you know, and this is, again, you know, everything should be audited. This is the world of blockchain. If you're not being transparent, we don't trust you, is essentially the whole mentality here.
Yeah. Especially to do it on a global scale.
Right, right. And so that's kind of the basics to at least Bitcoin's price movement.
That sketchy thing about Tether you said kind of reminds me of OneCoin. Have you heard of that one?
I'm not familiar.
That's the one that I've heard a lot about. I think it was in 2016. This woman, this doctor, started OneCoin, and they're calling her like the crypto queen and everything. And she said it's the Bitcoin killer. I'll attach the article I found by BBC.
Says it's a Ponzi scheme.
Yeah, it definitely was. And it basically, so what she did was actually like make all these rich people like pay her money and give her these like quote unquote like one coin contracts. And then after like a couple of years, she was like, oh, we're actually looking for engineers to build our system for us, our blockchain.
Classic.
And everyone was like, are you serious? Like, so they were just holding this basically on paper for millions of dollars. I think she made like 30 million euro, something like that.
One massive IOU, man.
Yeah, I mean, 2017 was the year for that stuff. It was off the chain. Like, there were so many scams going on. My favorite, you guys should post the link. It's the BitConnect one. I don't know if you guys have seen that.
Oh, yes. I remember that guy.
So much fun. That was a classic, just off the shelf pyramid scheme, just like your typical pyramid scheme.
I love that.
Took
guy.
Place in se- took place in South America, and you know, it was a travesty. He definitely got over on a lot of people, but that one speech he gives, it's comic gold, man. It's
BitConnect.
I'm gonna have to look this up after. I feel like I'm missing out right now.
It's good. Yeah, it's definitely good.
The guy turned into a complete meme.
Totally.
That is a
good totally. One. But so yeah, there's tons of scams. Definitely. If you're not like it, you have to do your due diligence with all of this stuff. You know, do not.
If they're pegged for assets.
What?
Especially if the price of something is pegged at a certain, like, for asset purposes, you would think that they have to be actually backed up by something cold, hard, and physical.
Correct. I mean, that issue that you just mentioned outside of crypto exists in gold too, right?
Like
paper, there's paper gold, and it's not a blockchain specific issue, but yeah, it's an issue.
It's so sketchy to just thinking about it, to back a cryptocurrency to a like a paper money like dollar, because dollars already backed by gold, right?
Right.
So when the price of gold changes, the price of dollar changes. So are we saying that we're going to stay with... Go ahead.
We left the gold standard a good while ago. And that's what... When you hear the term fiat money versus, you know, crypto, that's what fiat means. It means... It basically just means paper. And it means that we don't... There's no... You can't take your dollars and go to the federal government and go, I'd like to have my gold, please.
I see.
That ability, I think it was 70s or 60s we lost that. I forget the exact
date. So why do we even have the gold reserve anymore?
There's a really interesting story. I'm going to forget it. Where when we left the gold reserve, Spain was like, nah, I'm not okay with this. And they literally sent a fleet of ships over to come collect all the gold that of dollars they had.
Oh, nice. Jesus.
Yeah, and it was like not that long ago. This is like the 70s.
Well,
it's pretty interesting. So, yeah, I mean, not everybody was cool with it, but this is where we're at. And then you enter what's called modern monetary theory. And, you know, this is, you know, you can talk about printing money and all this stuff. And I don't want to go down that whole tangent at the moment. But yeah, it's super interesting, though. But all right, to try and circle back here.
Sorry.
To the Ethereum, it's all good. This is how it goes. With the Ethereum thing, so I wanted to try and talk about Brave. I don't know if you guys got a chance to glance at it.
Yep.
I looked at it quickly, but it's hard to understand. I felt like when I first came to work, like all of the, there's a lot of acronyms and stuff you don't know. So it's hard for me to.
Yes. And totally understandable. It is definitely not the simplest thing, but it's really cool what they're doing. And so, full disclosure, I do own this asset. So just so everybody knows, and I'm not a financial advisor. Don't listen to me at all. This is just for entertainment. But
yeah, save yourself. Thank you.
Yes, I have to. But it's really cool what they're doing. So, like I explained before, with the DEX, and you have this concept of peer-to-peer transaction. If you look at the world of advertising and online advertising, you have three entities. You have the people who want to buy eyeballs, right? They want to push ads to eyeballs. Then you have us, right? The users of all of these free services, the eyeballs. And then you have companies like Google and Facebook who middleman that transaction, right? They take the value. They take the value from the advertisers. They take our value as a product, and they package it and sell it. So, and we all know the privacy issues inherent with that, right? When Instagram feels like it's listening to our conversation, and now I have an ad for something I was just talking about and all that crazy stuff. So what Brave is doing is they are using the Ethereum blockchain. They have their own smart contract on the blockchain for these Brave tokens. And in the browser, they can calculate, you know, eyeball value in browser, right? They could say, you know, I'm looking at this, I clicked on this, all that good stuff. And so, now, go ahead.
So they assign each, so this is under the assumption that almost each tab we visit has an assigned value to it based on the user.
That's part of it. So they also push ads like pop-up notifications if you allow them to.
Okay.
So to explain the ads real quick, to go backtrack a little bit, they have three ways of using this browser. Standard, just like you do is Chrome. You wouldn't even be able to tell them apart. They're both Chromium-based browsers. You can use it like normal. You can use it with built-in ad blocker, or you can use it with Brave ads. Now, if you use the Brave ads function, you get a wallet address in your browser, and you will be seeing ads provided by Brave, right? And these advertisers are, they buy basic attention token from an exchange, okay? And then they go, okay, I'm gonna buy these eyeballs through this decentralized application. I'm gonna take this crypto and I'm gonna pay people to look at my ads, essentially. So for example, I on my home computer here, let me pull up real quick. Claim my rewards. You gotta prove I'm human with
so dragon. If I think I know where you're getting at here, it's let me just see if I'm processing information. And so Brave, when you use it and somebody wants to provide an ad, they can connect with Brave to do this, but essentially they're paying still the consumer for the ad, so the person using Brave. However, Brave has to do something with those tokens that you were talking about. So I'm assuming they have to like operate on them,
no,
right?
So here's the key thing here. Brave as a company does not really do anything with the tokens. They might have some and they may distribute them in certain ways, but the transaction between, so right now, for the past month, I've earned 52.9 basic attention token with a value of 38 US dollars currently based on today's value. Mm-hmm. That's just using my browser, okay? And I can take these, withdraw them, and send them to an exchange and get, you know, whatever I want, dollars, whatever.
Oh, okay.
Now, so I got paid to look at ads. Now, the person who wants to push ads to us, right, will buy these basic attention tokens. They will go to they'll go to, you know, Brave, the company that is distributing these, and they can say, hey, like I want to push these ads to people, and then the money trickles back to me. It's pretty cool.
Wow. I can see the full circle right there.
The loop, right. And so that it's very interesting. And the really interesting part is the privacy factor. So my clicks, my eyeballs, my person is not sent to build a profile. It's like purchased directly. It's pretty cool. And so this is just one example of how you can kind of integrate. When you use this browser, you have no idea what's happening on the back end, right? Nobody needs to know. Nobody needs to know about that. The user interface feels exactly original to how you use a browser. But what's happening on the back end is the value transfer and the way things are reaching you is entirely different. The whole back end has changed. And this concept of that back end changing of value flow is pressing into all sorts of different places. It's pressing into insurance is a huge one, right? Now, instead of having an insurance company, you can actually like have an insurance contract. Same concept, right?
I'm having trouble making the.
So instead of a peer-to-peer transaction, we have a peer-to-market type style of transaction, right? So, you know, the three of us can decide, hey, we wanna bet on this insurance, whatever it is. We wanna make some sort of thing. So we all submit Ethereum into the smart contract. The contract holds this, and then we can create different types of rules on how the payouts work. Simple type of payout would be like, we need two of the three people to agree to pay out the third person in a case of an incident. Right. So say we want to insure all, we all have a car. We all want to insure our cars. We don't want to go through an insurance company. We pay into this contract. And then if one of us gets into an accident, the other two can validate that and say, okay, pay out the money. And that's an insurance contract in its like simplest form.
Wow. Okay. That's pretty interesting. That's an entirely, I don't know what you would call that. I had a word for it, but it's leaving me now.
Yeah, the buzzwords, that's the fun part about this industry. It's just like, right, you're trying to put a word on that. People do that all the time. There probably is like 10 different words, you know?
Uh-huh.
But it's super cool. And so this back-end style thing, right? So, Matt, you know, you don't need to know that that's how your value is flowing. You can imagine a company like, I don't know, Geico, implementing a smart contract in their backend. Maybe they want to spread risk between Geico and Allstate. And so Geico and Allstate can say, hey, you know, we want to prepare for some cataclysmic event like a pandemic or something and, you know, spread risk and have different ways of unlocking funds.
Fires in California because PG&E is still out here, you know?
Right. You know, maybe, you know, that's another, you know, there's all types of contracts. You can have PG&E lock money up for when they inevitably light things on fire.
Yeah. That's a crazy. You can get into there.
You can get into voting, right? Because it's transparent and secure.
Would be something.
I think that's I hope to see that in my lifetime for sure. Because of the
transparent anonymous voting.
Not anonymous. You know, well, you'd still need to be assigned your private key from the government.
Yeah.
So that you could vote, you could interact with the blockchain. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's doable. You know, and then another fun one is, you know, video games.
I saw this on there. I don't know what application this goes into though.
So like World of Warcraft, whatever video game you're into, RuneScape, mm-hmm. whatever. There's money in the game, right?
Mm-hmm.
What if that money was exchangeable on an exchange?
Oh God.
Because it's a smart contract.
Wow. That sounds like the CSGO skins.
Yeah.
it's legit though. There's actual games that you can play that have real money tied to them.
What's that in space one that people study? Eve. They literally study that economy.
That game. I want to play that game, but I also want to have a life. Like that game is so immense and so large. It's so intriguing to me, but it's such a hole. You know, you're saying like economists have like you can dedicate. It's like a whole other world.
They study it and like model it to predict like actual world occurrence in the economy.
Yeah, and so that like that can actually be a real economy is the crazy part. Like that no longer has to be secluded to its own back end where it cannot interact with other back ends and financial systems. That back end can now interact publicly.
So where we're moving now is universal,
mm-hmm.
almost, because you don't need a government to put into place any of these things at all, almost.
Yeah, pretty much. Now again, there's caveats here. These things are not at maturity at 100%. So. You know, Ethereum still has its limitations. Like I was talking about with the gas prices. You know, some of these contracts can get expensive to interact with. You know, and you know, when Ethereum was a lot cheaper and these concepts were first, you know, developed and toyed with, it was fun to throw $60 into a video game, play around with it, you know, whatever. And you're like, you could sleep easy at night. You know, when the price has now moved to where it's at today, it's no longer about $60, right? I mean, you can put in small values, but because of how it's aged, it's so there's issues there, right? Like games can be a little tricky. Yeah. But that's not to say that these are definitely not in the process of being solved. So Ethereum's the by far king of the smart contract space. I mean, it's the only one that has legitimate smart contracts. But there's a lot of people coming up very up the reins really quick who are launching it, like Polkadot, Cardano. These are other some a few others that will be implementing a smart contract platform.
In all of these smart contract platforms, mm-hmm. when we talk about blockchain, yeah. Are they attached? Like, I don't know how to ask the question. Like, is it all in a singular blockchain?
I think I know how you're. Yeah. No. So here's the deal. And this is why I was calling them protocols in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to be on the Bitcoin blockchain, you want to be interacting and mining the Bitcoin blockchain, you have to be running the exact same protocol. If you change the protocol and start adding blocks in a new way, you would be executing what's called a hard fork. Okay, so there's one block, it goes to the next block, then that block goes to two blocks. Now you have two different chains. This has happened many times. You got Bitcoin Cash, right? That's a fork. You got Ethereum Classic and Ethereum. Ethereum Classic is actually a really interesting short story. The founders founded it really early on. One of the guys in the group was malicious. I'm not exactly sure what he did, but he stole a bunch. They were like, no, we can't continue to run the Ethereum Foundation this way with this robbery.
Yeah.
And you can't go back and edit the blockchain, right? So what did they do? They went back before he stole the money. They changed the rules. They hard forked the blockchain. And they created a new blockchain called Ethereum. And then the old one became Ethereum Classic.
And they just deprecated it on the spot.
On the spot, yep. And
that's funny, dude.
It's very funny. It's very funny. And it's the crazy part is that Ethereum Classic didn't just like shrivel away to nothingness like it should have, right? Like when you hard fork this, what you're doing is you're splitting the mining or hashing power, right? So you have all of these servers that are distributed. When you fork, you can only be processing one set of rules. You can't be building both chains simultaneously, right? So you're splitting the computation power. And so this is when you want to upgrade a protocol, like the Ethereum protocol or a platform, they have EIPs or Ethereum Improvement Proposals. And you have to get all the miners, or at least a huge majority of them, to be like, we agree with this. We think this is going to be an improvement. We will all update our protocol. We will all start mining on this, and that's how changes can happen.
How did they know? Did the miners vote? How did they know? So the miners know that they have a vote in these types of things. It's just like a known type of thing.
It's an inherent thing, right? Like when you run the mining software, you've chosen a protocol essentially. And now when people, you know, if there's a proposal, a public proposal, and, you know, people talk and vote and people say, all right, I'm going to stop with this existing way of doing things. And I'm going to start with this piece of software. So it basically, to the uninitiated, it would be like, running, you know, Ethereum mining 1.2. And then you're like, all right, I'm going to stop that. And now I'm going to run Ethereum mining 1.3.
That makes sense. Okay.
Yeah. And so there's a change in the underlying protocol. And so that's the hard fork, which is a really interesting concept. I never thought about that. It's pretty interesting. So there's a new proposal coming up very soon for Ethereum. That's pretty interesting. You guys can all read about it. I don't want to go too far into it, but it's supposed to have an interesting effect. And then one of the downsides of this method of modifying public distributed platforms, which is so
like
difficult
a hard fork?
To do. Yeah.
Okay.
Is that the miners, let's say they want to change the protocol and it's going to be effective, right? It's going to speed up the network. It's going to be better for all the users, but the miners make less money. They're not going to do it.
Right.
That makes sense. That's so funny, dude.
Right. Oh, so then you get into this whole crazy game of how do you do this? And that's a very tricky problem. That's a very, very tricky problem. Because if you force an update and split your network, that's not good for the efficiency of the network.
Oh, that effectively decays it.
Yes. And then, you know, yes. So the key thing about consensus technology is you need to agree on what technology you're going to come to consensus with. So, yeah. Kind of something that you don't necessarily think about. Yes, totally, totally. But it's so cool. It's such interesting stuff, you know. And some other interesting projects that in the U.S. are banned. Right, you're not allowed to do a lot of things in the U.S. There's when you start looking at eccentric crypto projects and new things. If you're talking about trading stocks. Having stable backed stocks on the Ethereum network, right? So some company will buy shares of whatever, GameStop, let's say, for timeliness, and they'll stable coin them essentially. They'll say, I have this share, and then they'll give a crypto, and now I'm trading in an unregulated market where I don't necessarily have to pay tax and things of that nature. Right. And that's what the whole stablecoin. That's what the whole stablecoin thing is. Right. So if you make money through trading, you want to transact, buy things that you can't buy with Bitcoin, I don't know, a cup of coffee, you need to get back to cash. And you don't always want to get back to cash because then you have to realize gains.
Uh-huh.
So that's part of that whole thing. But yeah, it's really funny when you look at these niche crypto projects that do things like stocks or other things where the U.S. government isn't so keen on it.
What
there'll
countries
be a list
do those
of tons-
pop up in?
All over the place. There's like a few countries it doesn't pop up in. And it's really funny because you see a list and it says not supported in America, North Korea, like all the sketchy places, all these, and it's just, and then America is there. You know, it's like America, Iran, North Korea, and a few other places don't allow it. But yeah, they're in Europe. Asia supports these things.
Yeah. That makes sense.
You know, we have KYC, Know Your Customer, and anti-money AML laws, anti-money laundering. So that's why when you go and sign up at an exchange in America, you got to do that photo ID picture stuff. Because they want to say, hey, this is who we're taxing.
Yeah. Well, they have to be explicit about that sort of stuff.
And that's why the DEX is an interesting place right now, because it's not shut downable. I can transact peer-to-peer. And nobody, yes, it is a public. Yes, they could go to my public address, follow the, say, oh, I sent money to this contract, see that something else came back. And yeah, it's there. But
the ability to force you paying taxes on.
Correct. And it really also takes like. Yeah, it'd be really difficult. So yeah, that's kind of some of the legal.
One last thing you had on the our notes here are NFTs. I wanted to learn about this personally, so I wanted to bring them up right now.
So an NFT is a non-fungible token. Fungibility is a fun word to say. It's kind of it essentially means differentiable. And at a high level, when you go to a store and you pay with a nickel or a quarter or something, it's not like they're like looking at the quarter and they're like, oh, this quarter is from this year. You know, it's got this much more metal in it. It's worth more. Now, to them, every quarter is exactly the same, right? Those would be fungible. You can take, nobody cares. Non-fungible tokens go into uniqueness. So you can have something that's provably unique, which is an interesting concept.
Like the original copy of a Mozart painting or something.
Correct. Yeah. And one of the cool places I've seen this pop up recently is in shoes. Shoes. Yeah. You know how there's like crazy expensive shoes and everybody's flipping them and they have the bots and all that stuff. Well, there's tons of counterfeits out there. And so, you know, you can put a private key or a piece of information in a shoe that makes it provably unique.
I see.
Which is pretty cool, you know, because it's the only way that you can this one piece of information is the only way you can interact with the blockchain. So you can prove that without a doubt, this is the one. And so this goes into video games. Video games are pretty big with this, right? Because you can create unique items in video games. Like think like, I don't know, when Fortnite or something does a drop, right? They have new gear that comes out all the time. You can have like a provable first edition, whatever. And there's a ton of inherent value in that. And if you look at the NFT market, it is out of control. There's like CryptoKitties was the first one, right? That was back in 2017. That was the first like mainstream NFT. And you can get two different, you know, you can get a kitty, somebody else can get a kitty, and you can breed them, and you can make another provably unique kitty. And then, you know, you'd have all these different ones, and some of them would have rare traits. And, you know, if you had one that was valuable, you could sell it for like hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Jesus Christ. So the only reason I know about these is I watch a YouTuber and he explained these. And he explained that this one, forgive me, I don't know the band, but they are selling NFTs of their album going out this year or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And they're only making a certain amount. There's only a certain amount of these NFTs for that given album, we'll call it. And that stuff, like, okay, so the difference between those NFTs and what like Spotify would play is literally just the original recording versus like a copy. That's where I'm like,
yes,
it's weird.
Yes,
to me.
So you can have a piece of audio that will sound the same, right? Like you can replicate that audio. But I can have an audio file and say, this is the first original one.
Yes.
Right. So this one's provably the original, which inherently makes it more valuable. Even though you're right, you can stream the song from Spotify, it's going to sound the same. But if there's this collectorness of it, right? Like I can go buy a record, but having that first vinyl press with the corresponding paperwork that I can hang on my wall, that's worth money to me. And so that's what NFTs are doing.
And that goes into another thing is like that YouTuber also showed me Logan Paul has these NFTs of freaking Pokemon cards.
Oh, yeah.
But in the NFT, it says that you do not own the physical card. You do not even own this moment in the YouTube video that he posted because the YouTube video is public. You just own this little part where it shows like it's the original video clip of him showing the Pokemon card. And that's it. That's all you own within the NFT. And that made me think about like how Pokemon or whatever would feel about an influencer using their, I don't know, But I guess you buy the product to get that randomization.
You're hitting on really interesting points right now. I mean, this is right. We're watching this unfold in front of our eyes. If I was Pokemon, I'd be pissed off.
Yeah. Right. Right.
I'd be like, totally. I'd be like, you're monetizing our what is it called? IP. It's our intellectual property. You can't be doing that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so new, you know. The legal infrastructure. To sue somebody for this would be to set precedents. So it's tricky. And Logan Paul is just the kind of guy who's like, fuck it. I'm sending it. Let's make some money. And he is.
And he is. Yeah. Yeah. And he is. And it's crazy. So, yeah. These things are so didn't even know about them until like earlier this week. Crazy.
It's pretty cool. You know,
it is cool that they give artists a way to make this, like, what the way I'm viewing it right now in this sense is that it gives artists a way to make money off of their art or product without having a label involved.
Yeah, and it creates this new level of value, right? Like,
oh, completely.
It's no longer just like the audio track. It's the audio track, and I paid the band directly. And they gave this to me, and I'm the only person who has it.
Mm-hmm.
And that I feel good about that, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I love this band. I want to support them. They gave me something unique. That's a successful trade for me.
Yeah, that's very true.
Very interesting.
And that is an interesting tokenomics way of circumventing Spotify and labels, right? Here's the transaction. They have content and music. I want to consume said content and music. How are we going to do this transaction? And here's just a new way of doing it. There's other ways that involve blockchain too that may not involve NFTs. It may involve just regular ERC.
Hello?
Okay. I was going to say we might have lost you right there because you went a little robot either for a sec.
Got a phone call there. Sorry about that.
Oh, we're all good.
But yeah, it's that's like tokenomics, and tokenomics is this whole really fun thing because that's when if you can come up with a good way of incentivizing people and driving transactions, you can make a lot of money.
Yeah, in this space for sure. We just watch Bitcoin do it. Although it's probably happening faster now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which, speaking of
which... Have any other questions?
Yeah, speaking of which, I had a couple of interesting rapid-fire questions, if you're willing to answer them. These questions, we are not, neither of us, and I don't think Kevin is either, our financial advisors. I'll take all
these. He stated that earlier. He is not.
Yeah. Take these all with a grain of salt, but let's talk about these. First of all, what do you think about the future of cryptocurrency? Is it going to go up? Is it going to drop? What do you think?
I think the future of cryptocurrency won't use the word cryptocurrency because it's not anymore. Bitcoin's not a currency. It's not intended to buy coffee.
Mm-hmm.
And Brave isn't a currency. I think what we're going to start to see is services and products transition back-end functionality to maybe not the tools as they are today, but tools of this nature of changing the how value moves between entities
and keeping track of like transactional type stuff.
Yeah. And I think it's going to seep into all sorts of products. I mean, we're already talking about it in shoes and music.
Mm-hmm.
And it's early.
That's super early.
Okay. Question number two. Do you think Ethereum will blow up like Bitcoin did?
I think yes. I think smart contracts are one of my favorite quotes. I can't take credit for this, but they say his name is escaping. I think it was Michael Sager might have said this, but it's Bitcoin's like digital gold and Ethereum's like digital oil. We've seen what's happened with oil. And I think that's a pretty good example.
Cool. Oh, okay. Wow.
And then, obviously, last but not least, we cannot leave Elon Musk out of an episode for Tech++. So how do you feel about Elon Musk and Dogecoin?
Tesla. Oh, I was going to say Tesla buying Bitcoin or having Bitcoin.
There's so many things, God. And after listening to your show, I'm surprised you didn't call him our Lord and Savior, Elon Musk. But yes, yeah. I think it's really interesting. He's got an incredible influence on internet culture. So it's,
seriously,
it's for sure nothing to smirk at. I'm a little personally, I'd say I'm a little ticked off at his like thing with Doge.
Mm-hmm.
Because from like a technical aspect, it's a meme coin. It's for tipping. It's not really providing that functionality. There's no hard cap to the amount. There's a whole bunch of things on why. I don't know. I think personally, I love Elon Musk. I love everything he's doing. I'm so excited for SpaceX. It's a Starlink thing, but the Doge thing, I think he kind of misled some naive people, and I'm sure a bunch of people probably lost money on that. But I'm happy that he's integrating Bitcoin into the payment system. And if it turns out, you know, quarter four of 2022 that Tesla generated substantial revenue by being able to accept Bitcoin for cars, you can be certain that other manufacturers and industries will follow. And not just with Bitcoin, but with other digital assets. So I think it's overall good, but
definitely,
yeah, that's my take on it.
Awesome. Well, those are my final questions. Any last words from Aaron?
No, I wanted to ask about Tesla and having Bitcoin because that was pretty big news that happened this year.
Yeah, it's great. It's great. He definitely knows what he's doing. I mean, I think he's trying to manipulate not only Tesla's stock price, you know, the stock price went up real high and I think they secured some funding and loans and stuff. So he knows what he's doing. I don't think it's all just kind of off a whim, but I think ultimately, I think it will be a positive force for the market as a whole.
He's a smart man.
He is a very smart man.
Kevin, I appreciate you coming on and talking with us. I learned a whole lot from this conversation. I really appreciate you taking the time for that.
I can't thank you guys enough. You know, I'm really passionate about all this stuff, and most people I talk to run away. So to be invited somewhere to talk about it, great.
Yeah,
thank you so much, Kevin.
So I wanted to create this platform, right? I'm a nerd. I want to talk about nerdy things, and this is something that has definitely piqued my interest.
Cool. Me too. Love to talk about it. Anytime, guys.
Well, yeah. Thank you, Kevin. I think that's going to do it for us for this episode of Tech++. Thank you for joining us for episode 3 here. You can check out our website here at www.techpluspluspodcast.com. That's techpluspluspodcast.com. Like Ali said in the intro, you can check out our Instagram at TechPlusPlusPodcast. That's TechPLUSPLUSPodcast. Twitter as well at TechPLUSPLUS_. That's TechPlusPlus_. Please check all those out, guys. Thank you very much for listening to this episode. Wanted to bring you some new information, some technical information about blockchain. And there it is for you. Thank you guys very much.
Thanks, everyone. And thank you, Kevin, again.
Thanks.